Welcome to Imagine This Podcast, where we discuss, celebrate, and highlight all of the excellent and abundant arts and culture in Milwaukee.
We hope that after listening to the pod, you'll see and experience our city and the incredible, vibrant arts and culture community in a new way.
I'm David Lee.
And I'm Mac Antigua. Hey, it's a special week, David.
It is. This is like the cross-platform Marvel Universe crossover thing.
I was actually thinking more when on NBC's Saturday Night Lineup, when they had the scene where like there was a hurricane that hit Florida. So you had the cast of Nurses and Empty Nest and Golden Girls all overlap. That was going to be my analogy.
So it's a crossover event.
It's a crossover special. It's a crossover special where the Milwaukee song, Strong song has been released. And on all our podcasts, where we've got a different element, a different actor, or if you will, different player in the production is going to be talking about it. So
yeah, today we have Kevin Suker, who mixed and helped produce the song. Tomorrow on Black Imagination, you will hear from Ray Nitti. And then on Thursday, Sam Ergani will be on Arts Forward MKE with Lindsay Sheridan.
Ray Nitti laid down the bridge, the rap bridge. He put 16 bars down on it, and Sammer shot the video for it. So
that's right,
360, baby. Nothing but the best for our loyal listeners.
This is why we created this podcast network, so we could take a 360 view at the production of the Milwaukee Strong song.
We need to have like a food based podcast so they can break down craft services for the video.
I don't know where Annie Peterson is on this, right? Like she ought to be covering this. She's the last
Annie Peterson's
person.
Gotta be on this. So yeah, it's all about Milwaukee Strong, and we're gonna have Kevin Suker of 88.9 up later, but before then, story time.
Yeah, so Mac, you and I are about the same vintage, and I think it's fair to say that we probably have very similar musical tastes.
I believe we've alienated many of our listeners because of our musical tastes.
Yeah, probably alienated some of our again, I almost called them cast members, our employees.
That is the mental model that you have about working at Imagine, by the way.
You know, we
are cast members.
Yeah, we often have been able to name an album and have you and I a reasoned discussion or sometimes an argument about how many bangers there are on an album.
Mostly an argument.
Which then oftentimes leads to a rabbit hole conversation about the production choices and the context for each song. And I think, you know, I think what has come to light for me in our conversations is that oftentimes people think of artistry as what is front of the song talent, but the sonic production choices we've talked about, right, when we nerd out on these songs made by the folks in the studio have so much to do with why we love a song, particularly you and me, I think, when we talk about, you know, like my particular love-hate relationship with Taylor Swift, for example. So for you, what has been a story that has illuminated this sort of back of the studio, behind the glass, world for you?
I just want to start by saying I love pop music growing up, and I still love it. And I'm fascinated by the production of it. Like you talked about, that like shows like Songland on NBC. I'm fascinated by see how people write songs and what it takes. So I'm in it. Other note, like to me, Max Martin, the Swedish producer who's produced more hits than Lennon and McCartney.
Yeah.
Number one albums, like fascinated by him and like musical math.
We were eating what, Thai food in Madison, talking about that Taylor Swift album and all the Max Martin bangers on it.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, but I'm not going to talk about Max Martin. That'll be another time.
That's another pod.
It's another pod. I wanted to, when you brought this up, I was inspired by, the Doobie Brothers and their track, What a Fool Believes.
What a great song.
What a great song. And that is a banger. That's like a first round. If I had to go like pop music, give me a pop song. I did this actually during March Madness a few years ago. I had like a Facebook polls and we would like pit pop songs against
that.
Each other.
I remember right. that.
This yeah, track yeah. made it to it the awesome. Final Four,
yeah.
which is What a Fool Believes, Doobie Brothers. And why I'm fascinated by it is
somebody on that one.
I love that song. To me, that should have won it all. Ted Templeton was the producer who had also produced Van Halen and a lot of their big hits, big hit makers of the 70s. But what was fascinating about that was that Ted Templeton produced that album. Apparently that song, Doobie Brothers got sick of that song. Like, they played that song so many times, they hated that song. And Templeton was so frustrated, namely with the drum sound. He said he wanted a floppy sound. That's the quotes that he said. I wanted a, which now when I hear the song, totally floppy. It's a rambly, you know, strutty kind of song when you hear it. He didn't like any of the ways that the drummer was doing it. He actually did the kit himself. He used to play drums. He sat down and did the drum track. And he was that obsessive to that. He even said, this song is a piece of S. Like, this song is a piece of crap. He didn't say crap. Like, he listened to this. And the people that he was playing it for were like, what are you talking about? That's a really good song. That's a good song. They finally did it. And I think they finally just picked out of exhaustion. They're like, fine, cut the album. Wins the Grammy for Song of the Year. And the Doobie Brothers literally had to push him to the microphone to accept the award. I just think that was fascinating that you could produce something and just go throughout the whole thing, like, I hate this. And he would say in interviews, he was just too close to it. He couldn't see the forest for the trees on it. That he goes, like, what he learned from is, like, sometimes you just got to get out of the way. Like, it's, you got good players, trust it. And how many hits, you know, might not have emerged because of that same point of view that they're able to, almost in spite of themselves, birth a legendary rock track.
You know, it reminds me of God, I can't remember the drummer on Asia for Steely Dan. But as you may know, Steely Dan is they're notorious in the studio, right? And so,
yes,
you know,
I love that we're referencing yacht rock bands.
Right. Yes.
This is yacht rock.
And the story behind the drum track in Steely Dan is they had a bunch of studio, like, giants come in to lay down that drum track. And I think I think they used the second take of I can't remember the drummer's name, but the second take from that drummer early on. So they've gone through all this time to get the absolute right drum sound, and they just went back to the original.
That's how it goes, right? Yeah. It's like, ah.
And when you listen to it, it is incredible. The drum track on Asia is 100% amazing. So the story that for me, and you know, this is the most recent rabbit hole I went down. I think I may have mentioned it on your Facebook page when your eldest daughter had showed up in that Def Leppard T-shirt, and I was like, oh, that's so weird. Because
backstory: my eldest daughter bought a Def Leppard T-shirt at Goodwill.
And she has no context.
I asked her, I didn't know you like Def Leppard. She's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, the name of the group is called Def Leppard. She looked, she's like, oh, I just like the shirt.
It
might as well have been Japanese characters, David.
Right.
Like, it might as well have been Chinese Japanese characters.
Well, I mean, so it's the album cover for Hysteria.
For Hysteria.
Yeah. And you know, I saw the photo, and I think I commented on your Facebook page. I was like, it's so funny that I'd spent the weekend down this Def Leppard Hysteria rabbit hole about Mutt Lang's vision for the album, which is basically, he was like, I want to make a Thriller for hard rock, right? And 12 singles, all bangers, and we're going to spend 5 years on it. And so I don't think they spent 5 years, I think they spent a year or two on it, but they would spend like weeks to record a guitar track. And I think he had pioneered like this way of recording guitars where it's basically string by string. It's not actually string by string. But the complexity of the guitar tracks are so incredible that when you see them live, or when you saw them live back in the day, even now, they're playing, they can't actually play the guitar parts the way it's recorded. They're playing pared down versions of it that mirror the sound of the recording. And like, that's just a level of genius and detail orientation that I just don't have, right? And it just, I personally find it just incredibly inspiring.
Animal, Women, Pour Some Sugar on Me, Hysteria, Armageddon It, Love Bites, Rocket. Seven singles,
that's right. And there's some other hits on that album too, like Run Ride's a pretty good song.
Rock of Ages?
No, that's Pyromania.
Oh, that's Pyromania.
Another Mutt Lang album.
Man.
Yeah, seven singles. Pour Some Sugar on Me actually came out pretty late in that run, and that was the single that really sort of launched the album into the stratosphere.
I don't know if there's a track that best captures growing up in Southwest suburban Chicago in that time than Pour Some Sugar on Me. You just that was like the Taylor Swift of its time. You couldn't like turn on the radio and not hear that at the pool.
That's right.
I smell suntan, burnt suntan lotion, hot dogs, That's anyway. And chlorine. And chlorine. You took me a time and place. That's a great album. Anyway, what makes a song a banger? Luckily for you, listener, we've got an expert to join us to help illuminate the conversation. Kevin Suker. He's the executive director at 88.9 Radio Milwaukee. He's a Milwaukee native, and he's worked as a professional musician for several years, teaching himself recording and sound engineering skills that eventually led to a career as a music producer. He's built relationships with artists and influential professionals in the industry, which grew into a national career in artist management. Let's name Eric Benet, David Foster, Train, The Tenors, Michelle Branch. That's a pretty diverse set of folks. It's a
good list of folks.
He's worked with. He's also been nominated for 3 Grammy Awards. He's also the uncredited executive producer on the Oscar-winning Dallas Buyers Club. McConaughey. All right, all right. And outside of that, back to the theme we were earlier talking about, he leads a yacht rock band called the Docksiders. That incredible CV aside, we're going to get his insights on all these questions about how it played out on working on Milwaukee Strong, which to effect, he was pretty much the producer of that song, which was written by Sean Hinton and performed by the Milwaukee All-Stars. Here's the track. We work together, we're heroes through and through. Like the foundation of our homes, we stand together, Milwaukee strong. Through the fire. Kevin, welcome to the pod.
It is super weird. I recognize that you are running a radio station and joining us on this this bizarre podcast platform that we have right now. So thank you for taking the time out of your day.
Thank you for having me, guys. This is an honor. I can't believe I'm actually sitting here with the Loggins in Messina.
Yes.
In Milwaukee.
Yes.
This is so great.
Well, see, now that we have your sign off, you're going to see us showing up next Docksider show wanting to fight to get on stage with you.
Listen. We don't, if you guys want to jump on stage, you guys just jump on stage.
I got to work on my Michael McDonald's. I got to work on my.
We're too old to push people off stage.
I'm working on it.
So to start, man, 5 months into your appointment, all of them during the pandemic, is this what you signed up for?
Absolutely. I mean, whoever would have thought that I'd be an executive director of an amazing organization and I would never have seen anybody. So this is all I expected and more. I mean, you couldn't ask for more and less responsibility at the same time. It's been amazing. No, I joke a little bit, but it's been very challenging. You know, we're all experiencing the pandemic at the same rate in one respect, but in another respect, you know, when you start a very important job during a pandemic, I didn't think it was going to be as difficult as it was. You know, I come from a world in the entertainment industry where everything's chaotic. So I operate in chaos quite normally. Like to me, that just feels like the last 30 years of my life. But, you know, this is a different vehicle. Being you know, an executive director of a nonprofit. So the staff is incredibly important, and my relationship with them, you know, I really feel like I'm hitting my stride now, but it probably would have gotten there a little bit quicker had we been in person.
It's one thing to try to do a project, a piece, but you're helming an institution, right? And that's a real nuance that's, you know, in some ways you've been preparing for it all your life, but sometimes every day is a new challenge, right? And something
100%. I mean, you hit the nail on the head, and really, you know, we talked about it. My wife and I talked about it when I was given this opportunity, that it really was a culmination of the experience of my lifetime getting ready for an opportunity like this. And it just really, it's happened at an amazing time for me personally.
So Kevin, we're celebrating the release of a new song. You're in the hit business. You just released a new hit. Milwaukee Strong was released recently, last week. Talk origin story. How does this project come together? Obviously it's with Jimmy Iovine and, like, you know, all these guys come together and they're like, we need to, Bob Geldof came to you and he's like, we need a track. So,
well, Bono called David Lee. And then David said, I got the guy in town.
I got a guy.
I got a guy.
I got a guy.
Yeah, right. The Milwaukee's equivalent to Bono, Mayor Barrett called. he called his office reached out to both Imagine MKE and Radio Milwaukee. And, you know, it really felt like an amazing time for a collaboration between, you know, we at Radio Milwaukee love Imagine MKE, and it was a very natural sort of partnership and collaboration. And, you know, when we were on the first phone call, it just was very natural feeling like, you know, hey, I suppose I could help with the song side of things. And David was very generous and felt like, you know, the visuals and everything else from that perspective would be easily handled within the Imagine MKE umbrella. And it just kind of went from there, and it's been evolving. Like even, you know, even today, now that the song is out, I still think we have some new things that we're going to be announcing rather soon that are going to be add-ons to what Milwaukee Strong is.
What's the genre of this song, Kevin? And once you name this genre, what would you say their elements of the genre? Because I think it's a unique genre, I would say.
Right. So, I mean, just to follow up on that question a little bit, like internally, we've had discussions, right, debates on the genre of the song. And just be very curious to get your insight on it.
Industry veteran.
It's funny you're asking this question, because Sean and I, when we were talking about, you know, where the song was going to live, and it's going to live on SoundCloud, you have to select the genre. So he and I were on the phone, and we were like, he said, what is the genre of this? And I just said, it's a pop song.
Yeah.
It's a straight up pop song. Like to me, there are hints of, you know, there's hints of gospel. There are hints of R&B, you know, Greg Koch played on it, his masterful slide guitar that's deeply rooted in the blues. So it's got sort of flavors that I believe encompass how diverse Milwaukee is. And that's what I love about the track. You know, I had the distinct challenge of mixing the song. and I mean, it was one of the most challenging mixes of my career, because you had 30 participants that all recorded independently of each other. You know, normally if we weren't in COVID world, we would have scheduled a recording session. Everybody would have come in at different scheduled times and contributed to the recording. We could have controlled the sounds of the microphones, the quality of the recording, the room that the source signal is recorded in. We had no control over it. And I have to be quite honest. The behind the scenes of how I had to reach back out to people after I heard what they sent in, there was a bunch that I said, you got to do it again. Yeah. You gotta go in your closet and sing into the row of shirts that you have in your closet. We need a more controlled sound from your voice. So this was an effort. This was really an interesting effort, but it was fun.
I mean, it is really incredible when you hear the final version. And I've remarked this to you, I've shared this with you in private, but like the song sounds incredible. Like it sounds like a humongous, big production. With a bunch of different voices, lots of different instruments. Like the first time I heard the next final mix, I was like, oh, this is a song on the radio. This is a single, right? And so I'd be curious, like, when is that point for you? Like going from demo to final, like at what point are you like, oh, this is it, right? This is the moment, these are the elements that we need to add in order to get it to that place of bigness and epicness.
That's another amazing question. And I think with every project or every song, there it has its own unique challenges. Some songs, no matter how hard you work on, they just don't ever come together like to what I would expect my expectation to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess it's kind of a blessing and a curse from the experience that I have, that I can hear some of the challenges and I can understand that it can only get to a certain point based upon the inherent inherent challenges of that particular recording. So like this one in particular, I'm an audio snob. I grew up in a time, I really, it's sad to say that, but I grew up in a time where, you know, producers and artists spent, you know, a lot of time and a lot of money perfecting their craft. And I'm a student of record production. And to me, I have this level of just internal expectation that, you know, I have to sometimes fight with myself, realizing I'm not going to necessarily get there because there was not that level of control from the very beginning. And that's where it all starts. And I mean, it honestly all starts with the song. So the song has to be written from a perspective and from a musical and a lyrical angle that it just has to connect first and foremost before, you know, it doesn't matter how many bells and whistles you throw into the cake. If the egg to flour ratio is wrong, you got a junky cake, no matter how you put it. Sorry to throw in a cooking reference there.
No, it's about that time.
Hey, pandemic happens, right?
No, I mean, when I react to the song, and David and I are I think the term dime store like music nerds about it.
I love it. Right. I love that.
Because like I'll watch Songcraft, like I'm in, or Songland, like I'm like I want to nerd out on. I listen, you know, my own roots. You know, what I love to hear. I love songwriters, good songwriters. You know, Lennon, McCartney. You know, at all, right? Mm-hmm. This song, right? What struck me about this song is that like I can sing along with it. And I say that as it's accessible. You said it's a pop song. Like it, when you think about what Milwaukee needs, it needs something that they can sing together. And at the risk of being over metaphorical, in a time of polarization, in a time of great distance physically, there's something about this song that's in people's wheelhouse. It's at a pace that people can be along with. It's something that a lot of people, if we ever get to a point that we're all in the same space, you could have a lot of like a choir, you know, anthemic. So to me, that's what struck me about the song. Like it's meant to be something that on one hand not terribly challenging to sing, like the national anthem. That's a really hard song to sing. But mm-hmm. this is something that I can imagine any age, a kid could find the hook, or someone who's really hard to, their voice is really hard, they could find ways to get into the song. That's how it landed on me, I would say. That's how it landed. I don't know if that was your intentionality, but that's
yeah, and listen, I'm a songwriter. I'm a producer and I'm a performer. And that made me, I feel, a very different manager when I managed artists. And what I learned through the managerial process with the creatives that I was managing is that I know enough to be pretty dangerous throughout all the processes of what goes on. But to me, I give kudos to Sean Hinton because I was very specific in what I asked of him, that what I felt the project needed. And I gave him one adjective because I didn't want to taint his thought process. It's a very delicate thought process as a creative. If you hear one thing, it can almost paint you in a corner from your ability to be really open to the creative process. So all I said to him was anthemic. Just think anthemic. Think something that you'd be at the Fiserv Forum and they could just play Through the Fire, Through the Rain, and everybody could kind of put their hands up in the air and feel Milwaukee together right there. Like that to me, and I think he nailed it. Like from that perspective, I don't think we could have done any better.
Yeah. It's incredible to me that every time we play it for somebody, their feedback is, I can't get it out of my head. Right. So to that point of being anthemic. And I remember Max actually, his first response after hearing the first demo was, oh, I can totally hear that at, what did you say, Miller Park?
Like, I hear Miller Park. Yeah. They're playing at Miller Park, like right before like, right before first pitch.
Say, right,
that's yeah,
right.
I'm hearing it through the thing, right?
Like people, well, I mean, like, you know, I'm gonna drop another earworm on you that's gonna never get out of your head for the rest of the week. But you know, Master Barry Manilow, before he made his career in as the balladeer and the And the performer that he was, he wrote a million jingles. And I am stuck on Band-Aids.
I'm a pepper, you're a pepper. Right? Be a pepper.
It's brilliant. Like
that. Be all that you can be in the army. He crushed it. All of those. Yeah.
All of that. Yeah.
Knows a hook.
That's the hook.
That's get the hook. What was it? I mean, you've got a massive experience producing music. And for you, like, and I just also heard in the story you just shared, you have to be very sensitive to every artist's process and how every artist comes to it. So it's almost like you're good at what you do, but you almost know how to allow the white space or the blanks to happen so that the artist could do that. But what allows you to know that something's gonna be a hit record or at least cross that threshold for you where it goes like, all right, I'm not just doing this gig to like get through the gig. Like it gives you goosebumps. Like what has to happen for you or do you notice any trends for you when you're with an artist or with this piece, a song, or maybe it happened on Strong, you know, Milwaukee Strong, maybe.
Listen, if I had that,
you wouldn't be the ED. You would not be the ED.
I would not be talking with you two. Right now.
That's because correct. We'd be going through your publicist to try to figure out.
Cabo and I'm some giant boat called the Piano Bar.
You and Sammy Hagar crushing Mai Tais.
I'm just teasing. I would never trade anything for sitting and talking with you guys. But it's a great question because there's no formula. Mm-hmm. There really is none, and it's a culminating.
I want it to be a formula, Kevin. That's what I'm begging. I'm begging for the formula.
But I wish it. I really wish that it was. Like I just wrote a song for my wife. Actually, she and I wrote a song together, and like the idea of songwriting and production, it's kind of like songwriting. Most importantly, like there are formulas, and there are sort of thought processes that you go through as a writer that you know. Are similar to that being a producer. And I think that's kind of what made my transition from a writer to a producer pretty natural for me. But we just wrote a song that I feel is probably the best song I've ever written. Wow. Now, and I've written two songs since then. And I think that like you either, it's weird. It's like a serendipitous moment that lyrically, structurally, musically, everything aligns. The choices that are made are just, you're always looking for that honest place of where the choices come from. You know, it's hard growing up a fan of like Stevie Wonder, and it's hard growing up a fan of like Duran Duran, or it's hard growing up when you have these like masterful compositions that have equally brilliant productions to not feel like you're borrowing or stealing or, but like they're really, it's challenging from a lot of different angles. And you really don't know, like I just finished a mix for my wife's next single and no joke, like I'll get up at 6:30 in the morning and I'll make what seems to be like a very minute changes to the mix. But it changes the overall song in a way that I think it hits differently. And sometimes this process, as crazy as it goes, and I know that, you know, typically if I were doing it on a commercial basis again, it would probably be, you mix like a song a day, basically. Wow. And then you print it and you move on to the next song. Or maybe it's a couple days, but like having the ability to have a studio in my home, I can kind of take my time and really kind of paint the picture and allow the picture to change and see if that perspective is any better than the perspective I had yesterday. And if it isn't, that helps me kind of make my decisions. But at the end of the day, it's my gut. It's my instinct. It's things that I tell young creatives, as I mentor a lot of young creatives, like trust your gut. Like sometimes your gut, like let's talk about Billie Eilish, for example. You know, this young woman who is, you know, she and her brother are doing some pretty masterful stuff. And you know, a lot of that can be, you know, gathered through some of their influences, but a lot of it is instinct too. Like you have it in you or you don't, that kind of thing. I still haven't figured that part.
I love that example of Billie Eilish, because for me, I joked that like she's America's soundtrack on movies, right? It's like you put a movie But I also think she's of the time. This, we're going to wonk out on pop nerdery. She captures the claustrophobia and the anxiety of, I think, of 2020 right. so great in her music. That, to your point, right? Like, it's just like that her instinct, which probably speaks to her own life experience, her own serendipity of like the amalgamations of her own lived in experience, delivers in a way where like she's speaking to my 14-year-old daughter. Massively.
Exactly.
So I mean, that's like, yeah.
And that's what I've learned about pop music in general. Like, yeah. the world that we live in today, people have too many choices. There's,
yeah.
I just watched a documentary about the recording process last night. I'm still a geek about all of this sound creation and manipulation and all that sort of stuff. And we, you know, the recording process has changed drastically. Before, artists had to spend thousands of dollars in a recording studio because they were the places that had the expensive equipment that could make things sound, you know, professional. Now everybody has a laptop, everybody has software. It's affordable for everybody to have a studio, and I'm putting up air quotes as I say that, in their home. But, you know, a takeaway that I learned from that film, and it was really cool to hear somebody say this, is that, you know, a lot of these younger people are recordists, not engineers, not producers. They're still trying to figure it out, and they're still trying to learn. And, you know, gosh, I can only imagine, like, I learned recording on a 2-inch tape machine where I was cutting tape and splicing things together with a grease pen and learning the art of the engineering of the record. And had I had access to YouTube back in those days, oh my gosh, that would have been amazing to have that sort of resource.
All the reps you would have gotten, all the just quick.
Yeah. Again, I'd be in Cabo and we would be talking differently. I'm just kidding.
We had Wes Tank on the pod a couple months ago or a couple weeks ago. It feels like months at this point. And we were talking a little, so I went to film school I studied film, and we were talking about like the level of access kids have today to the ability to just make content. And make videos. And a kid going into college now has more experience behind a camera cutting stories or content together than I ever had graduating from a pretty good film program. And like, I can't imagine what that's like and what the sort of inflection point there's going to be for content in the next 20 or 30 years, right? Because these kids have, to Mac's point, they have the reps in, right? They might not be artists, they might be recordists, they might be contentists, right? But they have skills. They have skills and sort of a feel for how content gets put together. And I think that's an interesting time for kids coming up today.
It certainly is. And so another takeaway from that documentary I watched about music and recording last night that I thought was really amazing, and it applies to what you just said, David. In the older days, there were record companies or film studios were the curators. Mm-hmm. Right now, there's nobody curating it. There's so much content and not a lot of great content in the world. And what it does is it dilutes the total. So, you know, you can't look at companies like Spotify or Apple Music to be the curators because they're just in the business of putting as much information into the world as humanly possible. So it has changed. Like the dynamic of not only creating value for talented people from that perspective and a monetizable revenue stream that can be generated from the intellectual property that's created, but it really has changed the method how creation happens and how accessible everybody has to content.
Yeah.
It's interesting, right? Like we could probably have an entire podcast talking about what happened and why the music business got away from fighting the trend of people sharing files with each other.
I think it goes back to when you talk about the money. It's all about the money, right?
This conversation. We should figure out how we do this because
we're gonna do a series.
Absolutely.
Let's pivot. You talked about Kevin, the song being Milwaukee, right? It pulls elements of Milwaukee, and it's in it. Milwaukee can see itself in it and hear itself in it. And I want to pivot to now enroll at 88.9 Radio Milwaukee. Would love to hear your take on what is it about? You know, you've been around the world, as Lisa Stansfield once saying to you, you've been around the world. You. Yep. What is it about, by the way, this is just me and David working all the time. We just reference music lyrics.
I love it.
The other person has to pick it up. So you, of course, you're an 88.9. You got to get this. What is it about the music scene that makes it uniquely Milwaukee through what you see? And again, you've got this vast experience working nationally, internationally.
Yeah,
what is it for you?
I grew up in a very different music scene in Milwaukee. There was a much healthier original music scene in Milwaukee in the 80s. And even in the 90s, I would say, for the most part, it's a very different scene right now. and a lot of people really want Milwaukee to be put on the map. Like, right? Like, you have bands like the Violent Femmes, you have bands like the Bodines that have essentially come from Milwaukee. But Milwaukee never had its moment like Minneapolis did. Milwaukee never had its moment like Seattle did. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's not a music city like Austin or Nashville. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the connective tissue that a New York or Los Angeles does to the industry. So Milwaukee is kind of on an island, you know, and Milwaukee doesn't have the history of the blues like Chicago does. So like, I've wanted Milwaukee to be recognized for decades. And I believe there are massively talented people in Milwaukee. I just think, the industry is gone. There's tons of clubs that have closed.
Yeah.
You know, live music venues are different. Milwaukee's also, you know, I'm not going to knock my Docksiders tribute act, which is, you know, tribute is a glorified word for a cover band. Milwaukee is a cover band town. Like, you can go to a festival or a church festival all around the city, and it's loaded with cover acts. And that sort of acceptance from an original standpoint doesn't have a wide net. It doesn't cast as wide of a net as songs that people are familiar with. So. Yeah. I wish that Milwaukee was a little bit more invested in the music scene. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it would, you know, I think it takes the community to really kind of change that.
Yeah. And I also imagine at some point those artists go to these other cities you mentioned, right? And so that also becomes a challenge, right? Of retaining, and because there needs to be like a critical mass, right? I'm thinking using Minneapolis, I'm thinking the movie Purple Rain. Right, the bands, the time, they're always at First Avenue trying to outdo each other and trying to, there's something about that, right?
They're really trying to evolve and trying to be the best they can be. Yeah. Not that doesn't happen in Milwaukee.
Right, it happens, but.
But you have to almost go to where the industry is. I get that question a lot when I mentor people. It's like, you know, should I move to Los Angeles or should I move to Nashville? And I say, I think it's good to get that experience outside of the city.
Yeah.
And I think it puts a lot in perspective. And I've been very fortunate, as you mentioned, you know, to travel the world and produce concerts all over the place and really, you know, you see what other countries and other cities around America, how they treat the concert business. And there's some areas that are incredible. And there are some areas that, you know, one of my favorite cities in the country is Miami. In my experience, it's the hardest ticket to sell in America. Like, for whatever reason, we've struggled. Every artist that I've represented, anytime we had a Miami offer would come into my desk, I would look at it and be like, uh-oh, this is going to be one of those nights on the calendar. Typically, you know, it can be a struggle. But I have high hopes for Milwaukee. And part of my hopes and why I was really attracted to the Radio Milwaukee opportunity was that I could help, you know, instigate some of that change and some of that look, you know, that to me is still, you know, in the back of my mind would be a really great sort of added benefit of me being involved at Radio Milwaukee.
You talked about public performance being a key driver, and we live in a pandemic world now. And so that almost takes that away. And I'm just sort of wondering from 88.9 or your perspective, are there experiments or innovations that could hold what that, you know, again, live real-time performance is electric. It's a key element of the music industry, the music scene. Can you talk about how you're trying to either like innovate on that or improvise given? we got to be 6 feet apart. And you can't be in a room, right? I don't. How are you looking at that, or what's the takes on that?
First and foremost, we care about everybody's health and safety. Yeah. So to me, there's no rush to put people in a position where they or their families could be sick. You know, we, even as an organization, we're successfully working from home. The majority of us, we have a couple full-time jocks that are in the building, but for the most part, it's more important that we respect all of our unique challenges that we have related to COVID. Everybody's family situation is different. Everybody might have different health reasonings to, and I don't really want to push that. And I feel the same. I know we do as an organization, we feel the same for our listening and our listeners and our donors and everybody that participates with Radio Milwaukee. So it really has decimated the live industry. And, you know, it is a big part of Radio Milwaukee's mission is, you know, in person, and we like to connect with people. So we're just kind of in the same place everybody else is, with let's just be safe, we'll get through this, we'll come out hopefully stronger than we did going in, and you know, we're just trying our best, we're trying our best to just be respectful of the situation.
And a project like the song is a way to bridge that. That's a way for folks to share that together, right?
And they can do that. I mean, even like last week when we were releasing the song, there was tentative plans of having an in-person press event
that
just made sense to keep everybody safe. So, you know, I think everybody's really trying, aside from my 18-year-old son, is trying to make the best choices and decisions. You know, he turned 18 last week, and he's still one of those kids that feels that he can go hang out with his friends. I digress.
I don't think that's an 18-year-old thing. That's a 14-year-old. That's a 16-year-old thing.
Yeah. That'd be a 44-year-old thing too. So are there any, you talked a little bit about sort of the ever-expanding world of content from places like Spotify, Apple Music, so on and so forth. And then clearly we have the issue of the pandemic ahead of us and whether or not we can even return to being able to experience live music together. Are there any other music industry, particularly, I guess, to Milwaukee music industry questions that keep you up at night as a longtime supporter, practitioner, and also now the leader of one of our key Milwaukee music institutions?
Yeah. It's the live thing. The live thing kind of keeps me up. You know, we are, as humans, we are people that like to be around other people. We like to congregate. We like to celebrate. Milwaukee is the city of festivals. Yeah. You know, this was devastating what happened to Summerfest this year. It's devastating what happened to our friends over at the Pabst Theater Group this year and all the other clubs around Milwaukee that have not been able to host in-person events. Like, these are legitimate, devastating acts of, you know, the world right now. So it's really... it's a struggle. I commend Gary Witt and the Pabst Theater Group for putting together the independent theater initiative where they're working together to try to save their rooms. That's so important to every city. I can't tell you how many, you know, tours I've been on around the world that, you know, you're going into a Live Nation room, and you know, these are major companies that their goal is to buy and put all these sort of independents out of business because they want to own it all. And this is a very delicate time, so I really hope, just for Milwaukee in general, and obviously for the music business that I feel so connected to for so many years, I have so many friends that are struggling to eat, and unemployment worked for some, and some still haven't seen check one. It's a struggle. You know, I commend Imagine MKE, and what you guys did with the Artist Relief Fund for our hometown was amazing. I remember seeing it start before I was even in my chair at Radio Milwaukee, and said, wow, this is an organization that is doing something to help in ways where, you know, quite honestly, this shouldn't be scary for anybody to hear, but like musicians are still making the same kind of money they were making in the 80s, local music. Yeah. Like, you know, you get people that go out and play for 4 hours a night and they walk away with $100, $125. Yeah. Like, you know, a full-time musician is, the true definition is you play gigs three nights a week, but you also have two part-time jobs.
Yeah.
And some other way of bolstering your income. There just is, it's so difficult to be a full-time musician today, especially in a city like Milwaukee. And I would love to try to figure out how to challenge that notion.
Kevin, we're going to make you the arts and culture czar.
This is your moment.
That's a tee up.
This is your moment.
What's the policy that moves the needle on what you just talked? It only lasts for 2 minutes, but you got right now here. Tell us what's going to change that? What's going to make that for those musicians?
Well, we're going to find a way to create a fund that will support creatives.
Yeah.
Support creatives and bolster creatives in a certain way that will help them stay creative. I mean, creativity and music in general, specifically is a very important piece of who we are as people. Like, you know, it's what we are at Radio Milwaukee. We connect people through music and through stories. So if we can't value that aspect of who we are as a community, as the news are, I'm walking in and I'm changing.
I love it. Minute one, it's moving. Boom.
And then I'm going to retire.
Fund is created. Catch me in Cabo.
I'll be in Cabo. You know, send me page me, put it on my beeper, and I'll call you on my bag phone.
Oh, Kevin, it was a glorious run. You as czar, and what David and I are committed at Imagine MKE is to keep the legacy of that, which the legacy of that is how can we ensure that our artists and creatives are sustained so they continue to bring that human element of what makes Milwaukee amazing, right? And what really makes it a place where we all get to thrive. We need to support that, invest in it, nurture it, water it, all these things. We're committed at Imagine MKE to do that. So we'll carry it, even though your term ends as our arts and cultures are. We raise a Mai Tai to you.
I'm just happy to know you guys. I really I'm very
that's
serious.
We know we're almost at the end of this conversation. Oh. How can the listeners find you, Kevin? Let's plug it. Let's see the plugs. How can they find you? Besides 88.9, which is number one on my dial on my car.
Right. Thank you for listening and thank you for supporting us. But personally, you can find me on the Facebook, you can find me on the Instagram, you can find me on the Twitter. All of my handles are at Kevin Suker. So it's pretty straightforward. And then the Docsiders on the Facebook, on the Instagram, and on the Twitter. Yeah, I'm old, so I call it the. No. I do that to really aggravate my kids as well. Is that on the Instagram? Dad, stop.
It's a machine that has a crank on the side. You just have to keep pulling it, and that's how it works.
Where do we feed the goat? You know, it's all that fun stuff. But yeah, like, you can find me on social medias. I have some fun, and we're on YouTube too.
Awesome. Docsiders. And hopefully when we get right soon, we'll be hearing the sweet, smooth sounds of the water.
Well, I can't announce yet, but we have another show at the Pabst Theater in 2021. Let's just hope that we get to 2021. We're all able to congregate.
Come on. And
I would love to invite my friends at Imagine MKE to join me for that night. It's going to be a fun night.
I'm going to get my captain's hat and make sure the scramble eggs are on.
I can't wait. And Mac, I'm serious. We're going to fight to get on that stage.
Come on. Let's go. More the merrier. Love it.
Thanks so much, Kat.
Thanks, guys. Keep fighting a good fight.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks, man.
Thanks.
He's such a lovely and joyful and abundant person.
He's an hashtag imaginary friend. He is a friend of the pod.
Yeah.
I would love to have him back just to talk about music in general. We're just riffing on music. Just like, tell me more.
I could see you holding back on like not wanting to ask him, like dive into the nerdery of
so many rabbit holes, so many like just asides and digressions. I just wanted to pick his brain about. And I think what I really appreciate about him is just, again, he's like joyful abundance, you know, it's in the sense that he is just, I can tell he loves it. He loves music. He loves producing music. He loves getting the most out of people, right? I think he loves maximizing artists and creativity. It's such a great energy to be around. And even though he's joyful about it, there's a rigor there, right? There's a steel edge of excellence he's driving for. I sense that, you know. Thankfully, I haven't been on the business end of that. Maybe.
I don't think you want the business.
Run it back, Mac. Do a different baseline. Do it. That sucks. That's trash. No, he would never do that. But he's got that commitment to excellence. So it was just a joy to have him on, and so grateful for his leadership on this project. And hopefully his continued leadership, you know, at 88.9 as it continues to steward culture and art for the city.
I think your takeaways from the conversation with him, I think are so emblematic of how I have experienced his being over the last few months working with him on this project. I mean, he's just got this incredible sense of generosity and openness, which I think is absolutely infectious. And I think 88.9 obviously is lucky to have him, and we are lucky to have him in our network and in our community. What a great guy.
You know who else we're lucky to have?
Our listeners.
Our listeners. Thank you for listening to another edition of the Imagine MKE Pod. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen. Get your podcast, rate us 5 stars, share the word, get it out there, folks. And talk to us at pod@imaginemke.org. Send us your loves, your hates, cries of shock or outrage, or just ideas of people we should be talking to.
We are on Twitter and Instagram @imagine_MKE or Facebook @imaginemke. Join the conversation on social media @imaginaryfriends. Make sure you listen to the rest of the exploration of Milwaukee Strong on Wednesday on Black Imagination. You'll have Ray Nitty, and on Thursday, Arts Forward MKE with Sam Argani and Lindsay Sheridan. Until then, we will see you next week.
Stay strong.